This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
I hate that you didn't get to hear me do the first intro just perfectly. This was the one time that I just nailed everything.
It was spot on.
Sorry that you're not done. But nonetheless, I have the pleasure of introducing once again.
For the third time.
Stephen DiMatte, an expert in, he's a biblical scholar and just a really, really, really knowledgeable guy. And we're excited. I'm on pins and needles. This has been like 2 weeks in the making to get to hear what these. So, Dr. DiMatte, let's go through it one more time on your end. I'm going to let you introduce yourself again. And okay. Also, he did fantastic introducing himself last time. Sorry that you missed it, but we're going to give him the third go round. So, Dr. DiMatte, I will hand it over to you.
Okay, great. So let me just start by saying I have a PhD in early Christianity and New Testament. I have MAs in classical studies and comparative literature and another upper level degree in Hellenistic Judaism that I got while I was in France for a while. I have several articles published on New Testament authors such as Paul, whom I wrote my doctoral dissertation about, his exegetical method of the Old Testament. So I've always been really interested in interpretive traditions. But during the last 10 years, I'd say I've been, my interests have shifted from the New Testament to the Old Testament, and I've been studying the Pentateuch, basically the first five books of the Old Testament. And largely, I've been interested in what scholars call source criticisms, understanding the different sources or texts that went into the compilation of what we now call the Pentateuch. So basically, one of the things that I've been interested in lately is interjecting this scholarship into the hotly debated public topic of contradictions, because at present there is really no expert voice sort of in that dialogue, and there's a lot we actually know about the collection of texts, these ancient texts we call the Bible. So me sort of providing you guys information about contradictions might help shape this public dialogue in more specific ways.
When you say contradictions, do you break them down like logical contradictions or scribal contradictions or apparent contradictions?
You know, I have visited various atheist websites that sort of giddily list contradictions, and some of which I cringe at. So coming from this from a scholarly perspective, let me just say back up, all of the contradictions in these 66 different books can be explained as a result of different authors or different textual traditions or different oral traditions or different ways scribes told stories, and both variations were later compiled. So all of them can be explained particularly that way. So when I get into a contradiction, I'm more interested in looking at the way two different authors thought about a particular theological idea, told a particular story differently, how religion changed from the 9th century Israel until the early Christian period. I mean, to think that religious authors did not have a changing or adaptable view of sacrifice, of prophecy, of even how one views God is ridiculous. So the Bible actually bears witness to all these different changes. So I've prepared a couple here, Stephen. So I more or less categorized some of the contradictions as storytellers. So storytellers told stories differently depending on their geographical location, depending on the time period. And then I would classify some as theological differences. So, you know, some texts of the Hebrew Bible claim that Yahweh does not regret things. He cannot repent. He's not human like that. Well, that's a later theological development. Earlier authors were pretty comfortable presenting Yahweh repenting, getting angry, changing his mind. So the theology sort of adopts and changes, and we have both theologies in the Old Testament. So I'm interested in that. And then changing religious ideas. So we have a lot of laws in the Old Testament that talk about festivals. Well, these festivals' dates and what they were actually got modified throughout the year. So I sort of classify them that way, Steve.
Just a second ago, you were talking about, you made an interesting point in your first introduction. Can you go back and tell people about the website that you started and up until this point, how many contradictions you have so far?
Right. So a few years ago now, I had already worked on compiling a different number of contradictions. So I decided to open up my first blog, as it were, basically contradictionsinthebible.com. And what I was doing was every single day posting a contradiction. So the first contradiction was the two different creation accounts in Genesis 1 and 2. And then the next day I posted another contradiction. Unfortunately, I have lost the habit of doing that. I really need to pick that habit back up, because the plan was to start with Genesis and end with the book of Revelation and really to go through the whole Bible in chronological order. But where I did stop, we had just entered into the book of Deuteronomy, and I think we already counted 380 contradictions there in the first four books of the Bible. And again, most of these, 99% of them, are explained by acknowledging different authors and different textual traditions.
What's the biggest one that you, or the one that you find the, like you said earlier, the ones that you cringe at? What's the most cringeworthy contradiction that you find that apologists use, or you know what I mean?
So for example, I was sent a message the other day on Twitter about Genesis 2 and God. Once they ate from the tree, God declared them, God said that they would die. So atheists often use that as well. That didn't happen in the text immediately. Therefore, it's a contradiction. That's part of the storytelling. I don't necessarily look at that as a contradiction. On the other hand, I could, you know, maybe later we can talk about some of the contradictions that I feel are extraordinary to talk about, actually, what these biblical scribes were doing. Quite intelligent individuals, was ingenious, actually.
Can you give us an example of one of those?
Yeah, so as you know, I published a book last year called Genesis 1 and 2, or Genesis 1 and the Creationism Debate, and I'm currently working on a book about the author of Deuteronomy. And Deuteronomy is a fascinating text, actually. So the book of Deuteronomy, if you read it on the surface level, Moses is speaking. And basically what Moses is doing, he's retelling particular events that happened in the wilderness period. But every time Moses retells these past stories, he tells them with variations and extreme contradictions. So let me just take a small one. At the opening of the book of Deuteronomy, Moses re-narrates the story of the origin of Israel's judiciary. He was visited by 600,000 people, and God put him in charge to charge other people to listen to the cases. And so the story itself is pretty bizarre. What sort of cases would there be in the wilderness sort of setting of the story? But anyhow, when you go back to the text of Exodus, there's another story, another scribe, another tradition told the origin of Israel's judiciary in a different way. And that was established by the Midianite Jethro. And he's completely absent in the Deuteronomist retelling. But the most significant thing in Deuteronomy is Moses retells the giving of the laws at Sinai or Horeb, depending on what tradition we're looking at. And basically, if you look at the book of Exodus recounts the giving of what we call the Ten Commandments. And then Exodus chapters 20 through 23 is a whole list of what scholars call case laws. that were given at Sinai, or they're presented. So we're talking about stories, nothing really historical. These are stories. So you establish a tradition and a law code by tacking it on to an ancient sort of event, as you would say. So the giving of the laws at Sinai. So Exodus 20 through 23, the people receive these laws. Now in Deuteronomy, when Moses re-narrates this event, he says, Yahweh only gave the people the Ten Commandments, and he gave me and my heir the laws that I'm going to give you in Deuteronomy 12 through 26. Now, that's interesting. It's a whole contradiction, because in Exodus, the people hear the laws and accept them, and there's a whole sacrificial ritual accepting them. In Deuteronomy, Moses says that's not happening. So that's at the surface level. What's happening now the biblical scholar comes in and say, well, the text of Deuteronomy was written around the 7th century, and there was religious laws that were being changed at the time. And what the author is actually doing, he's substantiating new laws, Deuteronomy 12 through 26, by presenting them as Moses simply re-narrating a past event. So that's one sort of very elaborate type of contradiction, and maybe I lost you guys a little bit in
not at all.
No. So who actually came up with the, when it comes to Deuteronomy, who wrote the Levitical Code? Where did that actually come from?
Right. So the Levitical Code will keep as the book of Leviticus, which is another total story. But Deuteronomy, so scholars surmise that if you read 2 Kings, I forget what chapter it is, but there is a historical king called Josiah. And during his reign, he is one of the kings that is looked at as quite he's a positive, good king. One of the things he did was a religious reform. So at that particular time, historically, Israelites could worship Yahweh at different altars throughout northern Israel and southern Judah. They could, I use that word, perhaps maybe I should choose a different word. They were also worshiping different other deities at this time. So we both know that from the biblical record and the archaeological record. Josiah's religious reforms actually centralized the religion in Jerusalem and banished all other altars, as it were. So scholars surmise that this, and that's part of the law code in Deuteronomy 12 through 26. So we surmise that this particular law code was written around the 7th century, or it might have been written earlier. And the story in Kings is that Josiah finds it. And then he's so impressed by it, he does this religious reform. But the thing is, the law code in Exodus 20 through 23, we surmise that that's probably written in northern Israel around 9th or 8th century. That's the earliest law codes. The book of Leviticus are the youngest. Those texts are all sacrificial texts. That's our author to Genesis, who wrote the book of Leviticus. I'll get back into that later. To that law code was written around probably the 5th century, 6th or 5th century BCE. And the law code in Deuteronomy, we surmise, written around the 7th century BCE in southern Judah. The ideology is strongly pro-Judah and pro the cult in Judah. And all these texts were later combined into the Sinai narrative, and they all happen. If you read the story from Exodus to Numbers, they all happen at the same time, even though they were written at completely different times and reflect completely different religious views.
So you think the main reason for most contradictions is because being written by so many different authors, each author kind of added something to it, which does explain an awful lot. For example, I've always said that if you want to argue a position from the Bible, you can pick one, find one passage, then somebody can take the opposite position and find a passage that supports their position. And is that kind of because so many people were involved in writing the Bible?
Yeah, so we have, if you estimate, so we have 66 texts, but you take a text like Exodus, where we know there was at least three hands into, in other words, the text sort of, it's Hebrew linguistic style, thematic, all tell us, so these are all conclusions that scholars get from the text, tell us that three different traditions sort of were stitched together. And then the text goes through a long process of editing that where editors freely change things. So yes, I mean, ideally we estimate maybe anywhere from 50 to 60 different authors over a time span of 1,000 years in vastly different geological, political situations and religious beliefs and worldviews. So the Bible, I love studying it because it bears witnesses to all those different changes.
How's the, when you talk about the editing part of it, how different is the original text from, let's say, the the Bible that we're used to today? Is there a difference between...
Not so much. I mean, the question is more complex. One, on the one hand, well, let me break it down a different way. So the book of Leviticus, which my last book on Genesis 1 talked about that, so I'm comfortable talking about a lot of that information. Again, based on textual evidence, we think that the text was written by an elite priestly guild that traced their lineage back to Aaron around the 5th or 6th century BCE. Kyle, I forgot your question. My apology.
Oh, I was asking in terms of editing, when you said that it goes through a bunch of editing, how different or is it?
Okay. That's what I was getting right. So this particular, scholars surmise that this particular textual tradition was written around the 5th or 6th period. So we don't actually have the original text that these priests wrote. What we actually have is how that text was stitched into other traditions that eventually became the Bible. So a lot of times we don't actually have the original per se. And then on the other hand, we do know, so the Septuagint was a Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. When we look at the Greek of some of these texts, such as the book of Job, for example, there are additions in the Greek version of the book of Job. So the Greek text was translated around the 2nd century that do not exist in our own Hebrew Bible of Job. So that tells, and the Dead Sea Scrolls, although there's a lot of similarities with the manuscript from which we get our Bible from today, there are many, many variations too. So we know at a certain point, scribes and editors who copied these texts were freely changing them to suit their own agendas, their own theological beliefs. And then at some point much later, the text sort of got viewed as concretized, that nobody makes any changes. So let me give you a small example of an editorial change, Kyle.
Sure.
So in the book of Exodus, during the Sinai revelation, the text tells us that Yahweh descends to the mountain. Moses ascends the mountain, sees Yahweh. Actually, if you read Exodus, there's one version that says Moses, one version says Moses and Aaron, one version says Moses and Aaron and 12 others. So those are all different traditions that sort of get compiled into Exodus chapter 24, I believe. When the Deuteronomist, so the 7th century text, has Moses re-narrate this text, scholars surmise, again, based on the study of the Hebrew, and I can offer some scholarly books for any of your viewers who are interested in this, that when the author of Deuteronomy wrote his version of the Sinai revelation, he had this older tradition in front of him, because we can see him modifying the Hebrew of the older tradition to suit his own agendas. And also, this 7th century author, he had different theological beliefs. One of his beliefs was that Yahweh doesn't ascend or descend. That's to present God in human terms. So in the Deuteronomist retelling of the Sinai event, he makes it explicitly clear Yahweh does not descend on the mountain. Yahweh never leaves heaven. Moses didn't view them. He heard or didn't see Yahweh. He heard a voice from heaven. So the author of Deuteronomy has a very different theological idea of the Godhead than the author of Exodus. And when he retells, or has Moses retell, the Sinai event, he changes it a bit to suit his own theology.
That's interesting. Why do you think that skipped over kind of so much nowadays? It's not really talked about that there are these, you know, stark differences between the two stories.
Yeah, and that's really the unfortunate situation. There might be a variety of different reasons, Kyle. I mean, a lot of our knowledge, that is the scholarly community, about this collection of ancient texts, we know quite a bit. Certainly, there's still many questions that go unanswered. But a lot of the reason is this information has just not gotten out to the public. And when you go through a local bookstore, I mean, how many scholarly books are there about the Bible? It seems like publishers and presses are more interested in subjective type of experiences and books by non-experts. So it's unfortunate that this information doesn't get out. And another reason is most Christians, this is an unfair generalization, but I'll make it anyhow. Most Christians just are not familiar with these ancient texts, nor the historical nor literary context that produced them.
It's kind of taboo, you know, you would think to approach it that way too. That may be a reason why it's you don't want to tread on the, you know, the Holy Scripture in a way that makes it look like it could be anything but the, you know, inspired Word of God, I guess you could say. How do you, how are you approaching it? Like, are you coming at this from a theistic standpoint?
Let me say the question is, your question needs to be modified. So let me do an analogy, and I often do this with my students as well. So let's say I was an astrophysicist, and I wanted to know what was the compositional nature of Mars, for example. So I would not draw an opinion about what Mars is made of based on my beliefs, my anything subjective. As a scientist, what I would do is gather the data that we have from Mars, whatever, or the moon, the material data, and then I would pose the question, okay, what is Mars composed of? Well, the data itself leads me to this conclusion. So I use that model to explain this is what I'm doing with the Bible. I don't write books about God in a metaphysical or ontological sense. I don't write books about faith. I don't write books about religion. I write books about a concrete object, a collection of ancient texts. So basically, right. So let me get into this because you brought up inspired Word of God and things like this, this idea. So basically, I could say that to ask the question whether the Bible is the Word of God, that's a valid question. Okay. But the question itself can't be answered by what I believe or don't believe, or what you believe or don't believe, feel, think, or imagine. That's not it. What we have to do is get into the text. So the textual data must sort of lead us to a particular conclusion in that question. And basically, this is what I do in my Genesis 1 and the creationism today. The first chapter shows us that this is not the Word of God. And basically, again, the book makes a stronger argument, but basically to go into that, because the creation account in Genesis 1 is a creation account of how the world was created from the perspective of the 6th or 7th century author. This would be 6th or 5th century author that wrote this particular text. So, for example, when you go into, I think that we talked about this last time, when you go into Genesis, one of the first things that happen is God creates a solid, domed, transparent barrier to separate this primordial body of waters. And to some extent, this later the text tells us, and God calls this Rakia, the sky. So the sky is envisioned as a solid dome barrier above which are blue waters. That's why the sky is blue. So then we understand this from the perspective of our author. Our author lives on a Mediterranean country. He looks out on the horizon and sees a body of blue water on the sea. And then he sees another body of blue that touches it on the far horizon. And he questions, well, how did this world that I perceive originate? And his response is the Genesis 1:3-5 verses here, that in the beginning there was a huge body of water. God created the sky to separate particular bodies. And the text goes on and on. The moon is seen as producing light because ancient men saw the moon producing light. Day itself is envisioned as inherently, or should I say, light is envisioned as an inherent property of day, so it's created before the sun, a variety. So the text tells us that the creation narrative is a result of the cultural perspective that our author had. It represents how the world as he perceived it and understood it was created.
What happens when you run into apologists, then? And you have two types of apologists. You have the one that'll say, yes, we agree with everything you've said, that obviously they're interpreting it from their perspective. That'd be more the old Earth and theistic evolution type. They understand that science has demonstrated the moon has not produced its own light. They know that that was all attributed to their limited understanding. And then you have the other apologist out there that just says, everything you've said is just wrong. The Bible is completely, completely literal. How is it they look at some of the contradictions, they look at the evidence that has been multiple people writing it, and they're able to come to a completely different conclusion?
Yeah, because the Genesis 1 and creationism debate, my book, the subtitle, and I particularly wrote the subtitle for my apologist brothers, the subtitle is Being Honest to the Text, Being Honest to the Author, Being Honest to His Beliefs. In general, Steve, I mean, a lot of Christian apologists just are not being honest to the text. And there are a variety of reasons of this. I mean, basically, my goal is not to defame any group. My goal is to sort of create a conversation between atheists and theists, because we have an object, an ancient text, and our conclusion should draw from that. But the problem is the label of this ancient text, the Holy Bible. So when you say the Holy Bible, that title, that label that gets applied to a collection of texts much later, one, the label represents the perspectives of a particular community that labeled the text the Holy Book. Bible is a Greek word that means book. So basically, the term translates to Holy Book. The word book itself is very misleading, because already we're talking about various different traditions. But what interests me is the label itself implies certain beliefs. It implies that we have a book. It implies that there's a single homogeneous narrative. It implies that it's authored by one person, and the implication is usually God. So usually Christians put their faith in the label. Mm-hmm. When a Christian says, I believe the Bible, what they actually are saying is they don't believe in all the varied beliefs of these texts written by 50 authors over a 1,000-year period. They believe in what the Holy Book as a label implies.
Does that also does that give it a divine status as well? I mean, I've actually met people that actually treat the Bible as a divine object.
Right. So the texts themselves tell us that that's not the case. And basically, my challenge to the Christian apologists, if they were going to argue the Bible is the Word of God, okay, how would you objectively defend that particular claim? I mean, what data in the text itself leads one to conclude that particular conclusion? Because the data sort of leads us to draw the complete opposite conclusion.
Let's kind of go into some examples in detail, right, of that. And I believe the one that you're most noted for would be the Genesis 1 and 2 account, correct?
To some extent, that's still on the back of my mind. Kyle, let me quickly run through. I made a list here of, sure, a variety of different contradictions that I sort of categorized different contradictions based on a similar story being told differently. A theological contradiction. So let me just run through this to sort of maybe overwhelm you with a couple examples, and then we'll get into it.
I love being overwhelmed.
And then we can get specific with some of this. Okay, So I labeled here, maybe I'll put this in front of me so you guys can see my face. So what I did, I went through and noted a couple storytellers. So in the ancient world, people did not have TVs, no radio, no nothing, no social media, no Twitter.
Stop the madness.
Really? Do you have a citation for that?
Maybe I need to substantiate that. So storytelling was the prominent mode. Storytelling happened in festivals, religious gatherings. Storytelling helped define who a people were, helped create identity, helped set political, religious worldviews, as it were. So the whole ancient world was imbued with storytelling. So the Bible bears witness to a lot of these stories. And as you can imagine, these stories were told with variation over time and over geographical events. Historical events happened, and then storytellers would change the way they told a story because of historical events. So let me read a number of these. First off, we do have two different stories of creation. We'll come back about that. We also have two different stories of flood. Once Noah was commanded to gather seven pairs of each animal, two pairs, that it rained for 40 days, rained for 150 days, that it actually rained. And the other version is that, no, this transparent sky that God created opened up and the primordial waters fell back to the earth. That's the same author that wrote Genesis 1. There's different stories on the origin of cities. So this was a very popular storytelling in the ancient world in general. So the city of Beersheba. So we have two stories on how the city got named, and they are contradictory. We have two stories about how Meribah, where Moses apparently struck the rock, and that city was named. We have two stories about a city called Horma. So the Hebrew word means destruction. In one story, the Israelites met the Amalekites there in a battle. The Amalekites destroyed the Israelites, and therefore they now call that place Horma, destruction. Another story, the storyteller told it differently. the Israelites met the Amalekites. Actually, I think it was a different group, the Amorites there. The Israelites completely destroyed the Amorites. That's why the city is now, this place is called Hormah, because the Israelites destroyed them. So these origin stories, the contradictions are not major or anything, but different authors told different stories. The origin of names. So there's different versions on how Ishmael, Israel get their name. The story of Hagar is told differently. How many years the Israelites spent in Egypt is a variety. The Red Sea. So let me go into this one. So the Red Sea was a story that was told differently. The crossing of the Red Sea. So we say Red Sea, but the Hebrew really means Sea of Reeds. But anyhow, if one carefully reads Exodus 14, paying attention to Hebrew vocabulary, stylistics, and the theme of the way Exodus 14 is shown, is discussed, one notices that there's actually two different crossing of the Red Sea story told here that were sort of stitched together. One story, I don't have the exact verses here, but I can, this is all on my website actually, but one story tells a story about how Yahweh all night long blew back the waters. And in the morning, the Israelites hid on the shore, and the Egyptians crossed over the seabed, and then Yahweh let the waters come over them, and they were washed up on the seashore. That's how that story is told. And if you take the verses that scholars have identified written by this author because of stylistic, linguistic, thematic similarities, if you take those verses out, you have a story that makes sense. There's no gaps in it. Yahweh all night long blew back the wind. The Israelites did not cross. They stood on the side. The Egyptians crossed over, and then they were washed up on the shore. We're more familiar with the way an older storyteller told the story. Moses had a rod, and he waved it across the Red Sea, and it parted. The Israelites went through, and the Egyptians followed, and the Egyptians didn't get washed up on the sea here, but they ended up being drowned. So these are two different ways stories were told, and scholars might speculate. The later... Go ahead.
Can I ask you a question before we move on from that? Who would be the one that stitches these stories together into one?
Right. So this would be a later particular editor. And again, here, Kyle, the question is more speculative for authors. For example, 100% confident there are contradictions in the Bible. The text tells me that. I have an object. But then if you were to ask, well, why did a later editor stitch together two contradictory versions of a story, well, we have to speculate. I don't have the mind of the author here. That's more of a speculative task. One of the things that scholars have thought might have been a scribal activity. The flood story also, the two stories are stitched together as well. So this might have been a scribal activity to try to preserve two traditions without throwing in away one or the other. The two creation stories, you can't stitch those together. So the editor said, okay, whole one, first one, whole second one. They must follow each other. Other scholars have surmised that what we call the Bible and the way we read it today as a narrative perhaps wasn't the way they read it back when they were creating these particular texts. The Bible might just have been an anthology where scribes just preserved various different versions of the story. In other words, their sole objective might have been just to collect different versions of the same story.
Oh, that's interesting. And another thing, before you go on with your list of contradictions, I want to hit back to, you said that there was a version of the flood that had seven pairs of...
Yeah, or seven animals. Maybe it wasn't pairs. I have to go back to the text, yeah.
But they wanted seven of each?
Yeah, seven of each. I think that's the way the wording was. And the other one was a pair of each animal, male and female, as it were. And when you look at the different strand, the story of the flood that tells Noah to collect seven, that particular story is an older story that ends after the flood. We rejoice and we give a sacrifice to Yahweh. So some of those animals were saved for a sacrificial rite to Yahweh. And the other one, there is no sacrificial rite at the end of that story.
What do they had to fit seven of each animal onto the boat.
What do you think?
Real quickly, what do you think of
the relationship between the flood in the Bible and the deluge that was in the Epic of Gilgamesh? Do you think there's a comparison there to be said?
Yeah, but not on a historical level, on a literary level.
Literary
So
level.
many of the cult yeah, so many of the cultures that were writing these texts were they lived on delta areas that often flooded. So imagine you're an ancient culture, you have a flat perspective of the world, it's very limited. You probably think the world is a finite space, and often the delta causes such drastic flooding that you could say the hyperbole, the whole earth is flooded. So these stories, so according to an ancient person, there was a natural element that threatened his existence daily. One of that was the uncontrollable force of water, especially if you're living on the delta. The other was death, and the other was fertility. So you have a god that can control all those natural elements. This is Yahweh's presented that way in the Exodus narratives. Marduk is presented that way. The Egyptian god Osiris. I mean, all these gods control these forces that were a constant threat to these ancient civilizations.
You can continue with you. I didn't mean to cut you off in the middle of your. You were on a roll there with your contradictions. I just wanted to. I was curious about the stitching together thing. I think that's a very interesting point to take note of.
Yeah, and that's something that scholars still debate on. I mean, there's things that we actually know for sure, like different sources cause different contradictory views, and then there's other things that we still debate on why was this stitching happening in particular. So that's an interesting question there, yeah.
Okay, did you have any more examples you wanted to run through?
Yeah, so just more examples of the storytelling type. So here, let me go into maybe a little bit. So there's two cities in northern Israel, Penuel and Bethel, and both of these cities sort of tell the story of how God changed Jacob's name to Israel at Penuel, and then later there's another story that says God changed Jacob's name to Israel at Bethel. So basically, these two cities wanted to accredit their foundation with the patriarch Jacob. So the Bible preserves both of those. So the editors who stitched this together, Kyle, felt like he didn't want to throw one of these stories out. So he made a more fuller narrative that sort of preserved both of these stories. There's more. Let me get into some of the more theological contradictions that I like to study more, because they sort of reveal, again, as a scholar, I'm really interested in what were these authors' theologies and religious views and even views of their God Yahweh. So in the book of Genesis, Genesis 4:26, and then there's a bunch of other chapters in Genesis, we hear a story where Eve evokes Yahweh by name for the first time. And then the text tells us from this time forward, the name Yahweh was invoked. So, in other words, the author that told this story is telling us that the earliest generation of humans knew who Yahweh was. And then also later in Genesis 11 and 12, Abraham is presented as establishing different cultic sites throughout northern Israel. And at each site, he invokes the name of Yahweh and sets up an altar to the name of Yahweh. So we know the text tells us that Abraham specifically knew God by his name Yahweh. And there's even a story of him having lunch with Yahweh on one occasion. When we get to a different textual tradition in the book of Exodus, Exodus chapter 6, verse 2 and 3, the author that wrote this text, so this is Moses meeting Yahweh for the first time. And the author of this text has his Yahweh in his text tell Moses, "Nobody before you, Moses, knew who I was by name. They all knew me through a different name, El Shaddai," which now scholars connect the origin of Yahweh back to the Canaanite god El, but that's a whole nother story. But anyhow, the contradiction is one author freely was free to say that Yahweh was known to the earliest generation of humans and henceforth. And another author was uncomfortable with that idea for whatever reason and pretty much put forward the contradictory idea. Moses was the first one that knew God by his names. So those are different theological differences as well. Another,
Interesting.
yeah. So, and Kyle, the unfortunate thing is I too, I find, I study this stuff because I find it fascinating. But
It is. I mean, it
the
is.
thing is, none of this information gets out to the general public, you know. And then when I listen to an atheist and theist talk about contradictions in the Bible, I sit there and have to close my laptop, you know. So to some extent, I have to elevate the conversation.
the contradictions that I think that you deal with mostly on YouTube in terms of the contradictions between atheists and theists, they're not even close to a level in detail as these things are. You know, like they don't even touch like the lunch with Yahweh thing. I've never myself.
I'm just picturing a picnic in my head.
Yeah, what would they order?
So I myself, I think it's a dinner. Yahweh and two other men come to visit Abraham. So I myself sort of made it a little parody by using the word lunch. So
I like it. but yeah, you don't deal with contradictions on in detail about that. And I wonder at what point, how can you just gloss over that substantial of accounts in one book?
Right. And, you know, Kyle, I mean, it really comes down to the issue. And I wrote about this in the conclusion of my book. And again, I'm very sympathetic towards Christians and where they're coming from. I'm not there to destroy religion, destroy God or anything like that. I'm here to destroy misbeliefs or misconceptions about a collection of ancient texts. But ultimately, when it really comes down to it, the label, the Holy Bible that we talked about earlier, that implies inerrancy, that implies divine authorship, that implies a homogeneous narrative. All of those implied beliefs in that title are more authoritative to a Christian in understanding this collection than what the text themselves actually say, than the varied and competing beliefs of our authors. So that's and that's what I mean. As a graduate student, I was interested in interpretive traditions. That's the real power of an interpretive tradition. You have a later interpretive tradition that says this is a book written by God. And what that interpretive tradition says about these texts is now more authoritative in describing the text than the text themselves. And that's the paradox of this.
Real quickly.
So the title has the power, not the text. Basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Real quickly, because you know, people missed the beginning because of issues. Could you want to get, again kind of go over your backgrounds on this? We have a theologian that's kind of taken a different approach and wondering what your what your area of specialty is in for your PhD.
Well, I wrote my PhD on Paul's Old Testament interpretation, and pretty much specifically, if this is specifically for a theologian, there's in the early church, there's a tradition that Paul started, a particular type of interpretation of the Old Testament that was Christological is really the wrong word. The specific word is typology. In other words, that Old Testament events prophesize the events of Jesus' life. So this is a very popular form of exegesis where a later Christian community reinterprets an earlier community. My dissertation pretty much said, no, Paul was not doing that. That's how later Christians perceived Paul. But in more general, I was interested in how later New Testament authors reinterpret the Old Testament to suit or even to answer theological questions and historical concerns of their own period.
Can we go into detail? We talked earlier about Genesis 1 and 2. This is something that I think is fascinating. The two, they're literally side by side, different accounts of the creation story, and how you can kind of skip over that and gloss over it, I guess, is kind of funny. But I like to explain the two different stories and why they're so obvious.
Right.
The author put them side by side.
So again, my book lays out 63-page textual argument of the detail. And over here on my other computer, I've got sort of noted a couple of talking points. So I'll get into that. Before I do, again, we might come back to this idea. If you have anyone approaching this collection of ancient literature and their starting point for understanding this is all the belief claims implied in the title, the Holy Bible. In other words, their starting point is this is the Word of God. This is inerrant. This is a single homogeneous, non-contradictory narrative. If that's their starting point, then they already start, Kyle, from somewhere else. They start from an exterior interpretive vantage point, and they're not starting with the text themselves.
They're biased. They're going to be biased.
Right. So that's the initial problem right off the way. So then the reading of the text is going to be a reading that's going to confirm these exterior belief claims that the particular reader has. So to some extent, I have to encourage my Christian readers to realize that all these later belief claims The text was written by God. It's inerrant. It's a homogeneous single narrative that leads to Christ coming back in the end days. Is actually a fabrication, if we will. It's really an interpretive tradition developed by a later reading community who had to answer their own issues and theological concerns. So doing that. So we have to set all of that aside and sort of get into the ancient text itself. So what did the author of Genesis 1 believe? And then I'm more interested in why he believed what he did. What did the author of Genesis 2 believe? Why did he believe what he did? How did he support his belief in the writing of his text? What literary techniques did he use to some extent? Okay, so let me run through a couple things that I talk more in more detail in my book about that. So on the public realm, usually when people talk about contradictions between Genesis 1 and 2, we hear that on the one hand, what's the order here? But anyhow, plants and animals all get created before man and woman get created in the image of God. And obviously the more glaring contradiction is in Genesis 2. No, we have earth, then man, then plants, and then animals, and then woman gets created separately, and it's a very drastic different creation an account. Let me just detail a couple more of these Genesis 1 lays out a calendar system, and I'll talk about why the author does that. It's a 7-day creant, but what the author is doing, he's creating a calendar, and basically he's saying, boom, this calendar was created by the creator, God, and it's embedded in the creation. So everything has a specific day. Genesis 2 starts off with, on the same day God made earth and sky, he also created plants, animals, and woman. Now, that didn't happen in Genesis 1. So then your apologist comes along and tries to brush these claims off. So the apologist is not interested in saying, why did this particular author, well, the apologist probably doesn't even know there's a different author here, but why does this text sort of express a different idea? That is the answer of a child coming into the text, an empty slate. We don't have any a priori assumptions about the text. And so basically the apologists will try to respond this on two different ways that deny what Genesis 1 was doing or the author of Genesis 1. So on the one hand, you can't understand. So this is Genesis 2, verse 4. You can't understand this literally. On the same day God created earth and sky, he created man, plants, and animals, having just read Genesis 1. That didn't happen. So then the apologists will say, okay, we must interpret this figuratively. And all there also, you deny what Genesis 1 was creating. If you read Genesis 1, the author is adamant about setting up specific days where events happen. I mean, the whole daytime is adamant. It's specific. There's a rhetorical device of repetition happen. To say that the same author later uses the term figuratively is just defaming this particular author. So that's another contradiction. In Genesis 1, the earth, in Genesis verse 9-10, when God creates earth, it emerges from the primordial waters that have been made into seas and oceans. So the text says, and let the earth appear, as it were, or be visible. So earth, as life-sustaining substance earth, emerges up from the waters below, and it's completely fecund. In other words, it's fertile. I mean, it has water all around it. In Genesis 2, the earth at creation is very different. It's barren. There is no man to till it, and there is no water source to give it water. So the image of earth is radically different. In the first creation account, man and women is created in the image of God. And I'll talk about why our authors sort of presented it that way. In the second creation account, the author is making a more elaborate theological and what scholars call ideological claim. So if you read the second account, the Hebrew word for man is Adam, and the Hebrew word for ground or earth is Adama. Only in the second account, I'll be more specific. So basically, we have a creation account. So our second, Genesis 2 tells us, the Hebrew tells us, Yahweh, the verb used is fashioned, formed, molded from the Adama, Adam. So it's an interesting story. So now we're here with a culture. So basically, Kyle, Steve, listeners, imagine you're living in a culture where the livelihood of most of the men, if you're uneducated, is agriculture. So we have an agricultural community. This storyteller is writing a story that explains why man life is bound to the earth. Basically, because in the beginning, God Yahweh molded Adam from the Adamah. So in Hebrew, it's a story that tells us not only what man is made of, the substance, earth, but also linguistically, my name, Adam, is the same as the earth, Adamah. So this sort of defines man in an intrinsic relationship with the earth. Now, what happens later in this story, just to go through this, now man is alone, and God scratches his head and says, so I'm dramatizing a little bit of the story to bring some humor in. Man says, okay, man needs a companion or a life partner or a helper is actually what the Hebrew text says. God says, I will fashion animals, the same verb, yatzar, it means to fashion, mold, from the Adamah and bring them to Adam so that he can find a corresponding helper for him. So this is an interesting text, actually, if you look at it. Again, it's all fascinating what these authors are doing.
It really is.
So man is created from the substance earth, Adamah. God now creates a bunch of animals from the same substance, Adamah, and brings them forward to man, and he's supposed to sort of identify the same essence in one of the animals and have a lifetime partner. The text tells us then that God failed in doing that. So this author was comfortable in presenting God in those particular terms, and we can talk about that as a talking point later. And now what Yahweh must do is fashion his partner not from the same substance that man was created, but now from the substance of man himself. So then we get the story that Adam was under sleep, and from his rib, Eve was created. So then once we get the story, another Hebrew word, so man is Adam, but also another Hebrew word is Ish. So that word can mean man or husband. So then the text tells us that woman, Isha, was created or built, the Hebrew word is built, from Ish. So this author is really interested in pun and word plays. We don't find any of this in Genesis 1. Adam created from Adamah. Isha is created from Ish. So it's completely it's a beautiful story. And then in the end, this author, it's also a story of the origins of matrimony. So why is it that man marries a woman? Well, because woman was literally taken from the flesh of man. So it's sort of a return. The essences are similar.
You know, it's
So
strange.
this type of
It's what you're saying just has a ring of truth. It's like I hear an apologist give me the narrative that they want to give from their perspective, which I think you said earlier, theologians come with it with a pre-bias. They start with their conclusion and they want to work the evidence to fit their narrative. But when I'm listening to you give a description of how these things came to be and how we understand them today, it makes sense. There's a ring of truth to it.
Right, because I've been practicing the deceptive art, Steve, for a long time.
It's kind of a beautiful story. I mean,
it really is. It's
take it
fascinating.
from it. It's kind of a beauty.
You know, and the thing is, my sole agenda, and I try telling apologists this, is to the best of my academic ability to present the beliefs and views of the author. I'm not concerned with what do I believe about this text or where I'm coming from or how somebody in the 20th century views this. Those are all irrelevant to me. I'm fascinated by ancient culture. I mean, basically, that's what I love doing. So my total goal is so when you read Genesis 1, the task is we enter into his worldview and try to understand it. We don't try to explain it from our scientific worldview or from a later theological interpretive grid that says this is the word of God. Those are all incorrect, and they're doing dishonesty to the text. Our task is to The text invites us into its worldview. That's the challenge. You go in there and see what this author was up to. It's fascinating.
So
it's
when
important to note that too, that you're not coming at it from a theist or atheist approach, but that you're just looking at a text and its contents and what it
Right.
says word for word. There's no, motive behind what you're
Right.
presenting.
You're doing it
Many of my friends.
objectively. Yeah.
Yeah, many of my friends have said I should write a book titled something like Up the Middle, where I take these theist and atheist arguments and sort of inject where biblical scholar. And again, if you had another biblical scholar on here, he'd be shaking his head. Pretty much this is mainstream scholarship. We all know this and we all agree about it, not because we all believe and think the same thing, because the text is telling us this. I mean, this is what the text tells us.
I have a random question, you may not be able to answer this. It's just something that I've always wondered about. But why do you think that the author of Genesis 2 chose that Eve should be fashioned from a rib? You know, that's just kind of an odd, way to...
I think there's an answer for that, Kyle. I don't off the top of my head know the Hebrew word for rib, but again, I guess it would be, so we say etymology. So language is used sometimes to mean something. So in the ancient world, everybody's name actually had a meaning. So I think the word rib probably had a specific meaning for this author that was attached to some element of woman or womanhood or something like that, I imagine.
Maybe that's where the name Reba comes from.
Do you think that was the Adam and Eve story came from, like, obviously the initial one with Lilith was his wife? And we've discussed that before in a prior episode, that Lilith was his wife. She had a fling with some archangel, and she was demonized, and all the offspring of her is now demons. Was that the predecessor to the Adam and Eve story? Is there kind of a relationship there?
No, so a story like that would come centuries later.
It would come afterwards, okay.
And right. And I don't know, one of the reasons is, right when you get, I mean, and again, the Christian apologists, again, our sole goal is to understand the text and their beliefs, but the oldest layers of the Bible and the Genesis 2 story is much older than Genesis 1, even though Genesis 1 is first, so it's a little bit complicated. But in the older theological layers of the Hebrew Bible, there is no Satan character. I mean, there's a Hebrew word, Satan, and usually Hebrew translate this with a slow S, but the Satan character is presented as an adversary, that's what the word Satan means, to mankind. He's not an adversary to Yahweh. And in a lot of texts, like the one that comes off mind, Exodus 4:11. So Yahweh, so the author of this text, to put it in perspective, has Yahweh say, I'm in charge of making somebody blind. I'm in charge of diseases and plague. I'm in charge of all that. There's a passage in Isaiah where the author has Yahweh says, I'm in charge of creating what's light. I'm in charge of what's creating what's evil and bad. So the theology, again, is that Yahweh is 100% sovereign. He's in control. You entered later, this idea of Satan, a separate entity emerged. So that's that whole theology. So you read the book of Leviticus and you ask, well, where is the enemy, to use that word, enemy of God in that text? There is no demons. There are no Satans. There's sin and illnesses. This is a priestly concept. So again, the Bible tells us that later theologies were changed. We move from a theology where Yahweh is viewed as 100% sovereign to a theology now where we have Satan explains the evil part of life and the temptation of men to do bad things, etc.
So all that Satan and all the hell stuff came long afterwards. Like our interpretation of hell, when people say, oh, you're condemned to hell, I see a lot of parallels like Dante's Inferno, and I think a lot of things that came from narratives, actual literature that had kind of molded the way society thinks of what hell would be. Because I've always thought the same thing with Satan. That was Satan. That was the adversary. It wasn't this character that was literally against God. It was a judgment of some kind.
Right. So I remember seeing a debate some time ago between some Jewish religious people, some Christian one, and Sam Harris was there representing the atheist side. And the debate question was misplaced. Do you believe in the afterlife? And again, from a scholarly perspective, going back to the literature, I can actually show you when in the literature the idea of an afterlife was created by man. What historical circumstances prompted the creation of that religious belief? So a lot of these things are pretty much fascinating. So if you go back to the Hebrew Bible, there's only one verse that alludes to some sort of afterlife existence, and that's in the text Daniel. And the text Daniel was written around 165, 168 BC. So it is the youngest of the texts of the Hebrew Bible. And I would surmise, now this is just a guess, I haven't really gone into the literature, but at this particular time, you know, Alexander the Great conquers the whole world in the 3rd century BC, connecting them. And I think Egyptian ideas of an afterlife sort of spread, Greek ideas of an afterlife. And I think the Hebrews or the Jewish community was later influenced by this. But also, Steve, it's much more complicated. And again, maybe I'll talk about an interesting contradiction in the text, also, that sort of comes back to this Satan or afterlife point. If you read the book of Deuteronomy, in the book of Deuteronomy, there's a theology of the land. So in the ancient world, the worst thing that could happen to your people. So imagine Israel is just a small country. They have superpower Egypt here on the bottom and Babylon and Mesopotamia up here. And a lot of times Israel was just a tromping ground when these two forces went to war. Where was I going with this? Sometimes I lose track of my particular thought.
It happens to me every day.
Yeah, it's a lot. Right? It's a lot. It's so much information to get compiled down into a small amount of time. We've all been there. Trust me. It's so much information.
Right. Is impressive. So, right. So the book of Deuteronomy. So let's talk about how the book of Deuteronomy presents salvation. So from the perspective of the author of Deuteronomy, from the perspective of the God of Deuteronomy, there is no afterlife. I mean, there's an afterlife. Souls go to what the Hebrew Bible calls Sheol, but there is no heaven or hell concept. But the worst punishment, this gets back to my geography, the worst punishment for people was loss of the land, to have another superpower come in and take your land away. So basically, when you read through the law book in Deuteronomy, there's a refrain that repeats all the time. And if you don't follow these laws, that is Deuteronomy 12 through 26, Yahweh will have a superpower come and take your land. All through that, if you don't follow these laws, your land will be taken away from you and you'll come into exile. Now, a lot of scholars, we think this text was actually written after that actually happened to the northern kingdom. So in the south, they're writing a text, hey, let's not have this happen to us. But in any case, so salvation is viewed as immediate death in this world or immediate loss of land. So basically, you're saving yourself from death or you're saving yourself from being taken over by a more superior, the Assyrians. The time period here is the Assyrians or the Israelites. Later, when we get into the Hellenistic area, the book of Daniel, as well as the book of Maccabees, introduces an interesting phenomenon, martyrdom. So what's actually happening during this time, after Alexander's empire sort of started collapsing on him, there was a king or several kings from Seleucid. This is a branch empire from the old Assyrians, came in and they took charge of Israel. And one of the things that they said is, okay, no more Jews are going to start practicing the Torah. We're going to ban Torah worship. One of the Seleucid kings, his name is Epiphanes IV, puts a statue of himself in the guise of Zeus in the temple in Jerusalem. He's in charge now. Okay, so basically the old theology in Deuteronomy says, the theology in the book of Deuteronomy says, if something evil is happening to me, if my land is being taken away, if I'm being suffering from illness, it's because I have not followed Yahweh's laws. So it's sort of empirical theology. Are you a sinner or not? Well, that depends. If you have no land, if your wife has been taken away from you, if you're ill, yes, you're a sinner. It's a very rudimentary and basic theology based on empirical evidence. So once we get to a later period, authors realize that theology doesn't work anymore. Now, during a foreign monarch, the Jews are suffering. So the Torah, following the Torah, has become illegal. But many Jews are willing to be obedient to Yahweh and the Torah, and they're being martyred, they're being killed to death. So now basically we have a situation where we have loyal Jews, but they're suffering. The old theology says they're suffering because they've sinned and they don't follow the law. So now we need to create a different theology that accounts for this suffering. There's various different ways to do it. These people are suffering for sins of their fathers, but another way is these people are loyal Jews following Yahweh's laws, and they're suffering for some mysterious reason. So this gets chalked up as a theological thing that humans can't explain. But they will be vindicated now, not in this life, but an afterlife. So now we have this idea. So even in the book of Revelation, the whole idea of an afterlife is vindicating those Christians that didn't deny Christ when they were brought in front of the Roman emperors. So this whole, one of the impetuses, I might say, of creating an afterlife was to vindicate those who were loyal to Yahweh, but who lived a life that looked like they were sinners. In other words, according to the old theology, they didn't have any land, they were suffering, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of these ideas. Yeah, I mean, it's all fascinating. And my naive My naive hope is that if we disseminate more of this knowledge to the public, I'm hoping that theists and atheists can sit down and have a conversation about the text. I mean, theists and atheists can have different subjective beliefs. Like Kyle, I have nothing against somebody says, I believe in God. That's great. But if you're going to sit here and tell me you believe in the God of the text of Leviticus, I'm going to say, no, you don't. And here's why. Because this text is presenting God as there's an eternal covenant. There's an eternal circumcision is a covenant. Sabbath is an eternal covenant. And there's a that's just a few.
What you're doing, though, is I have, long since said that you can't make sense of the Bible. But I think what you're actually doing is, based on how it is written, you're actually making sense of why this says this and why this contradicts this. I think you're doing a better service than you are trying to, inhibit any Christian in their belief or anything. I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a correct approach to take to it.
Yeah.
And often when I'm in a conversation with apologists, often, and I use words that offend my atheist brothers as well, but I use the word brothers in both sense. Both atheists and theists are my brothers, because that's the conversation I want to have. It's all about humanity evolving and moving together intellectually and spiritually towards whatever goal we may be working towards.
Here.
But a lot of times I use the word defend. I'm defending the text and the beliefs of the authors. Now, I'm not in using the word defend. I'm not saying that we believe that. You can't believe a 3,000-year-old worldview. Psychologically, we are in a very, very different place. But defend means just simply acknowledge that he believes something different than this author, that he believes something different than you in the 21st century.
You want to keep faithful reproduction to the author's intent of what he wrote.
Right.
Defend's a good word, I think, there. I think that's a... Cause you're You're not defending a belief. You're defending actual, text, like you said.
Right, or I'm defending the belief of the particular author and sort of having us simply acknowledge that different belief and then move the conversation forward. I mean, I end my creationism book by saying basically creationists have a choice and fundamentalist Christians have a choice. And I simplify this. One, they can either believe in the belief claims of the label, the Holy Bible, and therefore deny the text themselves. Or they can start studying the text and simply acknowledge the variant beliefs of our different authors. And that's going to be a huge courageous move. But once that is done, then we can move the conversation forward. Okay, so the Bible's not the word of God. Okay, so the Bible represents varying different beliefs of these ancient peoples. Okay, so what bearing does that have on my belief of God, this society? What bearing does that have on my religious views? That's the direction that the conversation should be moved. But we're stuck in this place where we can't be honest with the text and the beliefs of the authors.
How would you answer that, though? If because a Christian's belief is based entirely on what the book says. So if they were to concede that, yes, you're correct in your analysis of these contradictions,
right,
it would totally nullify essentially
right,
their belief. So, in a sense, they can't do that, I don't think.
Well, right. So when we step, so when we step out and start talking about these larger issues, they're much, much more complex. So let me, on the one hand, I have many of colleagues who are biblical scholars that know exactly what I know about the biblical text. They still have faith in God or Jesus. They just don't define faith as inerrancy, et cetera, et cetera. They know better. They know the text. So basically it's this, and I don't know, it'd be an interesting research project to go back in history and look where faith changed to some extent, rather than having faith and belief of God in a metaphysical or ontological text. Now the faith is directed towards a collection of ancient texts that most of these people who are proclaiming faith don't understand these texts at all. So that's an interesting project there to look for that.
It's all is my mind's going like 9,000 different. I don't see how you can keep this kind of all this knowledge and be so readily able to speak about it, because there's just so many moving pieces. Like you said, you only got to 300 and some contradictions,
right,
up to the book of Deuteronomy,
right.
There's still 50 some odd books left to go. So at what
right,
number would you arrive at?
Yeah, so eventually I never know, but there's probably over thousand and a half, maybe. And again, to some extent, we should be celebrating this because really we have an anthology of texts that bear witness, the texts themselves, to changing theologies, different ways storytellers told stories. I mean, to use an analogy that I'm sure some people are going to misinterpret, some of the apologists, we in our culture do not get offended when we watch two completely contradictory Superman movies or two completely contradictory Spider-Man movies. I mean, to some extent, these movies, so if we talk about fiction, if we talk about the truth value of fiction, so from our culture, we understand Superman and Spider-Man, they're fiction. Therefore, an author can tell a story in completely contradictory ways. And we don't, there's no conversation about that as well. But to some extent, these fictions have a truth value. They represent perhaps our ideology, our America's psychology. I mean, we're stuck in this good versus evil type of myth that we sort of perpetuate. And obviously, we are the saviors of this world. But my point is, in antiquity, this is an analogy to say, in antiquity, these stories were also, like our Spider-Man and Superman, these stories were also told with variation in Greek culture. In Assyrian culture, in Hindu culture, all these cultures were storyteller cultures that variously retold these stories. There was no problem with any of that. I mean, a scribe was, I might say, was obliged to change the details of a story to answer a particular historical concern of his own time period.
That's a brilliant analogy, I think. I think that works perfectly.
And do you think there's something to be said, though, that all fictional characters, and again, I'm not saying God's fictional or not, but just similarity. And if you do allow for fictional truth statements to be true or false, let's assume for that. But do you think that because all things we know about a fictional character has been given to by man, man has said this is the conditions we want this character to have. These are the abilities we want this character to have. We've never discovered anything about Superman. We've never discovered anything about Spider-Man. Right. It's always been told to us through narrative. Is there a similarity there with God? Because we've obviously never discovered anything about God that we can say God had this property. We've attributed properties to God. And if you have that many people writing that many things about him, all these different authors, are they individually attributing something to God? Is there something to be said that does a fictional relationship between all those things?
Right.
Those characters?
So, those are really good questions. And obviously I don't have to answer all of them, but you know, sometimes I like to separate what might be, for example, we can talk about God in what I would call a metaphysical or ontological sense of a being existing somewhere out there, whatever out there means. So completely divorced from this text that we're talking about. And at the moment, I believe, but again, scientists would have to step in. This is a conversation for scientists, but I believe this is an epistemological problem. We as human beings do not know whether there is or is not God in a metaphysical, ontological sense. Or maybe a scientist wants to step in and say, no, we do know.
I would say it's a philosophical problem, not a science problem. I don't think science would even be able to address that, would they?
Huh?
Science. I don't know if science could even be able to address that. I mean, obviously, if it's an ontological, it would be philosophical. Or metaphysical, yeah.
Right, but usually we don't do that. Usually, when a Christian says, "I believe in God," he believes he. Again, let me say this in rather stronger language. He falsely identifies the character in a text with an ontological God out there. So that's actually that's a false connection.
You think there's a disconnect there?
Himself is making.
You think that if there is an
So when Richard Friedman plays God in a movie, is there a connection between him and God in an ontological sense?
Good question.
I mean, we're talking. So basically, and my readers misunderstand too. Whenever I do talk about God, I'm talking how a specific author understood his God. And that may be dramatically different than the way a 21st century understands God. Dramatically different.
Yeah, I definitely see your approach is definitely from the literature and not from the ontological aspect of God. Huge distinction there.
So let me go back into a couple other contradictions that I find are interesting.
While you do that, Dr. Diamante, let me say this. If you don't mind, do you mind taking a couple questions towards the end from some people who are in the live chat?
Not at all. That sounds great.
So let's go ahead and get, if you have any questions, get those together and we'll take those while Dr. Diamante goes through a couple more examples of some contradictions. I just want to put that out there. Sorry to interrupt you.
Okay, that sounds great. That sounds great, because the more people we get involved in a conversation, I think, again, I naively think we can make some progress.
Great.
Am I ready?
Yeah, go ahead. Just you were saying you had some more contradictions that you wanted to.
Yeah. So let me paint the backdrop. So we know, again, from the texts themselves, that there were different priestly clans that were rivals that actually fought for the title of being priests of Yahweh. So if you read the book of Leviticus, the text itself tells us that that book was written by an elite, highly educated priestly group that traced their lineage back to Aaron. Now, Aaron was one of three sons of Levi. I think there's three. There might be four. I forget. But one of three sons of Levi. But in this text, he has Yahweh say repeatedly that the only people that can be priests are descendants of Aaron. So not Levites in general, descendants of Aaron. And the text also, so this author, the same author also wrote various different texts in Numbers. And if later readers want to know how scholars know this, I can tell them. But in Numbers, there's a passage from the same author that says the Levites are demoted to just helping the Aaronites. They cannot officiate over a sacrifice. They cannot eat tiffs. They cannot eat sacrificial meat. They cannot burn incense. They cannot atone for sin. Now, that's the picture of Yahweh in Leviticus, written by an Aaronite priest. Yahweh, in this text, Yahweh is pro-Aaronite, anti-Levite. When you read the book of Deuteronomy, our author of Deuteronomy is a Levite. And in this text, Yahweh says, all Levites are priests. All Levites can burn incense. All Levites can eat tiffs, etc. So these contradictions sort of exist between, they show us that different rival priestly groups wrote texts to sort of substantiate their own position. Now, what's interesting here, the book of Leviticus is actually a later text than Deuteronomy. So when the author of Leviticus is writing, the priesthood are Levites. Now he's trying to make the claim that only Aaronites can be priests. What does he do? He writes a text. He writes a text in the 6th or 5th century. The setting of this text, so think of movie, if my reader has to. The setting of this text is back in some archaic past, the giving of the laws at Sinai. So that's the narrative setting of the text he's writing in the 6th century. And in the chronology of the Bible, it's before the book of Deuteronomy. So basically, in this text, he has Yahweh say, look, only Aaronites are priests. And he has Yahweh pronounce the word, this is an eternal covenant of the priesthood, only to the Aaronites. So that's how this 6th century author substantiates his priests as being priests. So now he's written a text that legitimates from the word of God his particular position in society against other priestly claimants to the same position.
That's so fascinating. It's so blatant to a certain extent.
But it makes sense. But it makes sense.
And actually what they're doing is what many movie guys are doing now, movie directors, they're actually writing what we would call a prequel. So they're actually, this scribe has sat down and wrote a prequel to the text that says Yahweh selected Levites for priests.
But that's kind of brilliant.
Saying, no, he didn't. Look at earlier.
That's a brilliant way to do it, though.
And then
the analogy to the movies that you come up with is brilliant to describe the.
And let me add one more to this. So then when you get to the text of Hebrews in the New Christian, now, Jesus is the only authoritative priest in the line of
Melchizedek.
I always say Melchizedek.
Right,
but now, if you go back into the history of the literature, this particular individual shows up in Genesis 14 or something way before Yahweh gave the laws at Sinai saying the Aaronites are the only priests. So he's using the same literary technique, going back further in history to substantiate his belief of the priesthood due to his own Christology. So it's all fascinating.
It really
stuff.
Is. We try to keep each show to around 2 hours, so we're kind of pushing on that
end. Okay.
We're going to take a couple of questions, and then we'd love to have you back sometime soon.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Some of these.
Okay. Great.
If you'd be willing, but Steve,
Sure. I think one of the biggest
You have any
questions, yeah, I think one of the bigger questions people are asking is where you stand on mythicism. Obviously, we had Richard Carrier on recently. I don't know if you've engaged with him or have any relationship to him. He promotes that Jesus was a hero class myth. There might have been some core to it, but for the most part, the man himself wasn't, he didn't exist for the most part. Do you subscribe to mythicism, or do you look at the narrative and say there probably was somebody?
No, and so it's interesting. Most biblical scholars would have my back here, and I think Bart Ehrman has written a book to the lay people saying that. So there's a variety of issues that I think get complicated, and to some extent, atheists are sort of weakening their position by presenting arguments like this. On the one hand, Steve, we have a culture where 99% of the people that lived 3,000 years ago, you can't Google them. We don't know anything about them. So it would not be anything significant if there was a character that existed and he was never mentioned by a historian. That happens to 99% of the people. Another issue, and I think this is the main issue of confusion. Now, most biblical scholars, and there is some debate on this, so to be honest, but most biblical scholars are comfortable saying the portrait of Jesus in the Gospels is a literary or theological creation. That I'm comfortable, so I subscribe to this. I'm comfortable saying that Jesus exists historically. Can I pinpoint him down by a historian or something? No, this is just the problem of ancient history in general. I can't do that with 99% of the people. But what I can do, based on the textual contradictions mostly in the Gospels, is say that each Gospel writer was creating an image of Jesus to suit their particular needs and audience. So the portrait of Jesus in the Gospels may be completely fiction, or you might want to put a percentage tag on that. So I think there's some confusion between the Jesus of the gospel not being historical and the other side, Jesus not being historical at all.
I definitely
Did
kind
you
of
get
agree.
that?
Yeah, I did, and I stand for kind of that position as well. I don't think it's really of critical importance how much if there was a person that existed by that went by that name, as opposed to what story was narrated about him well after the fact by multiple different authors. Because I find that to be a
Right.
lot more of interest to me, whether he existed or not. But of course, the existence of Jesus as a man is obviously a prerequisite for the Christian faith. And if that man did not exist, then obviously Christianity fails as a whole, right? So there is that to be said
Yeah,
from there.
Stephen, you're breaking. You're breaking up a little bit
Yeah,
there
Steve, your mic's
as well.
your mic's breaking up.
I'll refresh the Hangout one
Let me
sec.
ask this question while we wait on him to refresh. Are there you hear accounts in similar religions, going back to Egypt and
Right.
like horse nose? Are there any earlier versions of the versions that we get Bible, like in the Old Testament? Are there any that are kind of similar or existed prior to the Bible itself?
Again, this is scholarship that I haven't been close to in a while, but the theme of Jesus in the tomb for 3 days is certainly a theme that you find in the Old Testament as well as other cultures. The moon disappears for 3 days, so this idea of a 3 day absence or something, or 3 day, just the number three becomes significant there. So that's certainly something that has a predecessors to it as well. But really, maybe what we might do, Kyle, is table the whole Christian conversation and Jesus for another conversation.
I think a good thing, because I know myself, I have like written down on my notebook several questions while we've been going along. So this is a good stopping point, I think, and we can I can get these questions together in a more
Right.
way. And also, audience, if you will too, keep those, and we'll table, like you said, this discussion for a so we can zero in on some certain things, and then you can bring your questions in, and we'll have kind of more time devoted to that. But
Well, Kyle, if your audience wanted to ask me questions about what we were just talking about, contradictions and stuff, I'd be more. I have the time to answer them now. I'm just thinking the Jesus stuff is a whole nother package that we'd have to.
well, the ones that we're getting aren't they're more towards the Christian, the
Okay,
Jesus
I see.
aspect
Okay.
towards
And
of it,
we
but
do got we got to end this in a few minutes.
Okay.
we appreciate this was absolutely fascinating. It's the fastest 2 hours that we've had on this show. I think that this is something that we could talk about probably for 4 or 5 more hours continuously. But
yeah.
I was listening intently. I was loving this. This is so fascinating to me.
It is fascinating. So we're going to have you back on at your early, you know, as soon as you can.
Okay, I will keep in contact with you. And again, thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to air this out. I mean, the more scholarship and knowledge of these texts that we can air out in the public, I mean, all the better.
Bio information I have in the video description. I have multiple links to multiple things that you've out there. So anything else you want to add, just let us know. We'll put the link in. But please check out his bio. Check out your book. Go ahead and talk about your book real quick.
Yeah, tell everybody where they can go to get your book and check out more about you.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you guys much.
Go ahead and let them know where they can find you, your website and all that.
My website is at contradictionsinthebible.com. I promise I'll try to get that going again. It's been several months since I've posted a post there. I actually have all the contradictions in Deuteronomy because I'm in the process of writing that book. So it's just a matter of me getting back there. So they can find me there at Amazon.com for my book as well.
Awesome. Well, Dr. DeMatte, we appreciate you one more time coming out with us. Next time we look forward to having an in-depth discussion, and this was fantastic. So thank you again.
Yep. Thank you guys.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for watching all.
And guys, thank you for watching, and we'll catch you tomorrow at 8:00.
This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel, and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McCrae.